Hey there to all of our automotive enthusiast friends all around the great big blue marble that we call planet Earth. Spinning so fast, some people wonder why we don't fall off. You did it again. You clicked that play button on yet another...
Kevin, yet another compendious episode of V8 Radio.
Compendious. Wow.
Sounds so regal, doesn't it?
Well, regal could be another adjective for the ship.
It could be.
What does compendious mean?
Compendious, meaning containing or presenting the essential facts of something in a comprehensive but concise way.
Wow. Well, that might actually be right this time.
It might be. I might have got it right.
I'm your host, Kevin Oostie, joined as always by our esteemed co-host, Mr. Mike Hubal Clark, and our very special guest this time, the lovely and talented Mrs. Kelly Oostie.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Hey, welcome back.
Yeah, it's been a while, hasn't it?
Been a couple minutes, yeah. Where you been?
I've been super busy. Super busy, Mike. Mm-hmm.
What? Come on. You don't lounge around eating bonbons all day?
I don't know that I've ever eaten a bonbon in my life, come to think of it.
Oh, we're going to fix that.
All right. Well, as you guys plan bonbons, the rest of the automotive enthusiasts from around the big blue planet Earth are expecting our traditional automotive trivia question that we lay out in the beginning of the show and, of course, answer at the end. And, of course, we're very generous here, so we're going to defer to our lovely guest. Kelly, have you, in fact, prepared a trivia question?
I have. For this episode?
Oh boy.
This one's interesting. Okay, so the trivia question from my side is, who is the inventor of the cylinder hone? And bonus question, ooh, when?
Mike, what do you think?
It's going to be Jebediah Hone in... the year 1875.
Ooh, okay. You might be right.
Final answer.
All right. Well, that's, you know, similar to what I was going to say.
Okay.
Mm. I think it's actually Horst Hirn. And he, in Germany, invented the Hirn. In 1784.
Ooh.
All right. You got that written down, Mike?
Very nice. I
okay.
do.
Who goes right, next?
Mr. Cueball goes next.
Mr. Cueball will go next.
All right.
Next.
Get short, sweet, and to the point.
Right, so. If you will.
Kevin, what was the year that Mr. Hirn invented the hone?
1766.
66. And could you spell that first
come
name?
On.
Horst, H-O-R-S-T, H-O-R-S-T.
All right. Okay. So here we go.
All right.
Short, sweet, to the point. So Kevin, in an earlier episode, I asked you if you could name all of the displacements that the production Chevy small block had. So today we're going
right.
to up our game and go for the... displacements for the production factory production Chevy big blocks. Can you name them?
Well, to answer that, I'm going to defer to our lovely
defer
guest.
To the lovely, because, talented Kelly.
mm-hmm. Do you mean like 454, is that what you're asking?
Mm.
Or are you asking liter sizes?
Well, I will accept either, because I'm cool
okay.
like that.
Okay. Well, I'm going to say there's the 454, the 496.
496?
Well, that was a custom build.
This oh, I can't go custom-y land?
Factory production.
All right. Fine.
Nothing aftermarket.
They did build...
We built the 496 for the Chevelle at one time. Stroker 454.
How many of them are there? Gosh, I don't know.
Well,
that's the question.
That is the question, though, isn't it?
396, 454,
mm-hmm.
409, maybe? I feel like that's in a song I've heard before.
So that's a good question, because what generations are we talking about here?
I did not specify.
Uh-huh.
And I feel like there's a five something. Five. Five something. Five. It's 502, 507, something like that. I that's all I'm giving up. I don't know.
Okay.
Did I say 427, by the way?
427.
Got to add the 427.
You did now.
Okay, 427, for sure. 427. Goes in there.
All right. So I got 454, 496, 396, 409, and 427.
Yeah, and there's a 500-something, but I can't remember what the number is. Go on. Let Kevin tell us, because he's got them all memorized.
Okay. Mr. Kevin Ostie.
Yeah, but every once in a while I get thrown on these things. I'm going to say technically the 348.
What?
Was a big block, W head. I think that fits. 396, like you're saying. 402. 427. 454. 502.
502, okay.
Yeah. There's the 8100, which I think is that 502, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's another one in there somewhere. There's like a, there's a goofy one.
Okay.
It's a truck engine. Mm-hmm. So we'll just say, and the goofy one.
And the goofy one.
And we'll be concise.
All right. Final answer? Yep.
Yeah, like a 376 or something too, but I don't know. Go ahead. We're moving on.
All right.
Final answer.
Duly noted. All right.
A lot of those weird displacement, you know, uncommon ones fall to the wayside in my memory.
Mm. Like, well, isn't that a shame?
Edsel motors and Mercuries and stuff. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, that was fun. I've got one for you guys. What? I guess there's several components to this. You can give me any unit of measure that you feel is appropriate. What is the largest crankshaft?
Well, come on. Are we talking like steamboats and stuff like that?
In the world.
Oh, my gosh.
They could be gigantic.
And they are gigantic.
Could be.
But, Kelly, since you are our guest, I defer to you.
You're asking for unit of measurement? Or,
yeah, think about a crankshaft. How would you describe it? You could say by the weight, by the stroke, by the, you know, whatever you want.
I'm going to say it weighs 2,000 pounds. It's like, say, 20 feet long. I don't know. Okay. It's got to be something giant, like a ship or something.
All right.
Okay.
All right. I got that. Kelly says it weighs 2,000 pounds and is 20 feet long.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I'm going to say that the largest crankshaft belongs on a cruise ship, and it is
the Pacific Princess.
Yeah, like the Princess, Royal Caribbean, that kind of thing.
With Gopher and Captain Steubing.
Right. And it weighs 10 tons.
10 tons.
And has a, I'm going to say it has a 5-foot stroke.
5-foot stroke. Wow. That's a big one.
That's a big one.
Okay. That's your final answer. 10
that
tons,
is,
5-foot
that
stroke.
Is.
Okay. Well, we will find out at the end of the show.
Okay.
Can't wait.
Boy. Yeah, no kidding.
Fast forward now, kids.
Yeah, because the rest of this.
They're going to miss all the. We miss
the
all the good stuff.
Yeah.
Well, before we dive into today's topic, which is by request, as a matter of fact, people ask Kelly and I quite often, how did we get started? How did the V8 Speed and Resto Shop come to be? What the heck happened?
Mm,
and here we are now. Right. We've not done this before on this show. We've kind of gotten close to it and here and there. But all right, so once upon a time,
I was wondering.
There was a boy named.
At what
Kevin.
Age does this story begin? But anyway, go on.
Well, so to pin this chronologically, we've just entered 2023, which technically could be considered the 20th year of our business, believe it or not.
Wow.
I know. In 2003 was the year that I had jumped ship from Hot Rod Magazine and their television show, and Kelly left the law firm she was working at, and we decided to set out and start our own deal. But the story starts a little bit before that. A couple of years, right?
Sure.
So in order to not make this a 10-volume episode, I think the shortest way to get there is this kind of recap how we met, which is another story in itself that I don't think has been fully explored here either, right?
I don't know. I thought you've told the Power Tour story, yeah. But maybe not.
I think we told the Power Tour story up until how I got my job working for Hot Rod. So you can rewind back to whatever episode that was and listen to that. But by 1999, I was producing Hot Rod Magazine TV, and part of the deal was you get to go on the Hot Rod Power Tour, especially if you are creating media, right? So I was shooting the event for television, and at that same time, my dad owned a 62 Ford Galaxy XL convertible that he had become increasingly frustrated with and told me that I need to pick this car up from his house or he's going to push it out into the street and just walk away. And that story, by the way, has recently been posted on our V8SpeedShop.com forum. Just go to the search box and type in 62 Galaxy. So the Galaxy at that point was almost put back together from a previous fender bender, and it hadn't been driven in about 4.5 years. So I picked it up and brought it to LA where I was living, and my friends and I and coworkers all kind of thrashed to finish putting this car together. It had fresh paint, trim got all redone, blah, blah, blah. We never really did much with the engine because it ran fine when my dad had a fender bender with it 4.5 years before. And that was kind of the fly in the ointment because in typical Power Tour fashion, you thrash like crazy to get going. The night before takeoff, it's not necessarily the maiden voyage, but it's pretty close. And the car broke every night on the Power Tour, single day. And day one, we developed a horrible rod knock in the 390 and had to put rod bearings in this thing in Flagstaff, Arizona, right?
Oh, brother.
Oh, yeah, it was something. So luckily, we met a lot of people along the way that were very helpful, and I think we bought all of the main bearings and rod bearings I could find in Flagstaff for a Ford 390. Because we didn't do any machine work. We didn't turn the crank or anything. We just pulled bearings out. So, you know, in that respect, without doing any machine work, standard bearings would be too loose. 10 under bearings would be too tight.
Awesome.
So I think we just put standards back in it and more things broke. But by the time we got to the Midwest and to the St. Louis area, it was knocking really bad once again. And Steve Bignante and I were contemplating what to do, and he had found a 428 that some guy was selling. It was in pieces, and I'm like, dude, I don't want to build a motor on the side of the road. But because I got work to do, but maybe if there's a way to get one. And meanwhile, a guy on the Power Tour offered up his house saying, hey, I don't live too far from here. If you bring the car over, we can work on it overnight and try and fix it. At the same time, another friend of mine that I'd met on the Power Tour said, I got a dealership in Indiana. We can drag it there, and you got a full dealership worth of tools and lifts and resources.
Nice.
Or this other dude's garage. And the guy driving the flatbed truck said, I'm not going to Indiana. We're in St. Louis at Gateway. I'm not going that far. We're going to this guy's house. And that was our friend Rod Euchner. And ended up taking the car to his house. And we're unloading the car, and lo and behold, Kelly is there.
Did your eyes just sparkle and your hair blow in the breeze and a song start playing?
No, I had very short hair.
Yeah?
Oh. No.
Did Dreamweaver start playing in your side of your head?
No. No.
I heard the violins.
It was not obvious to me that you heard anything. My version.
Well, I was hearing rods knocking.
Right. My version of that story is that I got a phone call in the middle of the day while I worked at the law firm. And it said, these guys from Hot Rod TV are coming to my house tonight and we're going to fix their engine. And I said, you don't know anybody that important. And he said, yeah, they're on Hot Rod Power Tour and they blew up their motor and we're rounding up a bunch of people to pull the motor out overnight and put a new motor in and get them back on the road the next day because they got to get to Tennessee the next day. Yeah. So I said, all right, I'll get out of work as quick as I can. I'll come over. And I did. I showed up and I knew what a Ford Galaxy was because my aunt had one as a child. And I recall walking into like 30 something people standing around eating pizza and drinking beer. And I was like, I thought we were here to pull a motor. Like, let's go. Right. So what I remember saying something like, oh, wow, a Ford Galaxy. And I think Kevin said, you know what this is. And I was like, well, yeah, I have family connection to it. So that's kind of where we started talking, I believe. From there, we pulled the motor out. There was maybe four or five people working on it while the rest were just having a party. And
nice.
We pulled the motor, and I remember very clearly the moment that Kevin knocked the pistons down into my hand out of the motor, and the rings were broke. And I looked...
It's a boy!
Yeah, I looked up at him, and I said, your rings are broke. And he was like... You could just, I felt like there was this look on his face, like, not only does she know what my car is, she also knows these engine parts.
Oh my gosh, who is this woman?
Yeah, yeah. There was a lot of that going on, for sure.
And that's awesome.
Well, yeah, and it's interesting to look back and see who was there, because Mike Cotton was there.
Yeah.
Who, you know, of course, now does some Motor Trend TV stuff. Mm-hmm. And Terry McGeehan was there. He and I were co-workers at Hot Rod at the time. And a whole bunch of other people that many of them I met again for the first time years after that happened. Mm-hmm. You know, people are coming up to me, like Brian Schilling, this brilliant paintless dent guy that we use, a good friend of ours at the shop. And he's telling me about that night. And I didn't realize he was there.
Oh, wow.
Until, you know, afterwards. But so I ended up buying a replacement engine from a local auto parts store. And it was like a 360 school bus motor or something. You know, it was an FE. That's all they had. Mm-hmm. And we dropped that in. And that was back in the days, you know, 1999 when, do you remember emailing jokes around?
Yeah.
You'd be on an email list of jokes, right?
Yeah.
Long before Facebook and memes and all that nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
And all the guys that helped put this car back together that night, we were all on this email chain. And Kelly was on that chain as well.
Nice.
And yeah. And so she's killing time at the law firm reading jokes. And, you know, I think you asked me, did you make it home? What was the big question?
Yeah, I got a joke forwarded to me from Rod and the group that was there that night. And I saw Kevin's email address. So I emailed him and I said, did you make it back to California with the motor that we helped put in? And that started the communication.
Nice.
Yeah.
And there it all begins.
Yeah.
Kevin was a journalist and a communicator, and he would write me back stories about driving the Galaxy on Highway 1, Pacific Coast Highway in California, and the sunsets and things like that. He was a great storyteller, and we hadn't really communicated on the phone yet at all. It was just reading his stories, and that's kind of started the emails going back and forth, and then eventually the phone calls started, and more stories, and then at the time, Kevin was covering a lot of NMCA racing, drag racing at Midwest drag race tracks. So he would fly in to Joliet or Memphis or something like that, mm-hmm. and I would drive. And we spent the entire... We never dated Friday night or Saturday night only. We dated from, say, Thursday night when I would come in from out of town. We would work together the entire race, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And then I would go home Sunday and he would go home Sunday. And then we'd see each other like a month later at another race.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, that's cool. I mean, that you knew early on that you could work together and you were compatible with each other in that respect.
From day one, we
that's huge.
Pulled a motor and put a motor back in overnight together on day one.
There's a lot of married people out there who would, you know, be divorced in 10 seconds if they had to work with each other.
Yeah.
And it is interesting because, you know, I kind of take it for granted today because we've been doing it so long. But, a good friend of mine, his dad told me, hey, if you find somebody you think is special, take her camping, you know, and see how that goes.
Yeah, right.
But all we did was work together from day one. So, like she's saying, it wasn't sitting around Friday night flipping TV channels. What do you want to do? I don't know. None of that. It was, I got to be at the track in the morning. If you want to come with and help. So she would, you know, be a production assistant, would shoot interviews and everything all day. And, and then, you know, Sunday night we had to break it off and return home. And that lasted for that whole summer.
It was 9 months we dated long distance.
Yeah.
Man, no kidding.
Long 9 months.
Mm-hmm. No doubt.
But then as fate would have it, the law firm that Kelly was working for had an office in California, in Santa Monica. So she put in for a transfer and was able to move to LA with a better job. And then she moved in with me in Hermosa Beach. Uh-huh. And that was fun because here's the farm girl from, you know, Southern Central Illinois going to California for the first time to live there.
It's like the opposite of Green Acres.
Yeah, I have two words, culture shock.
Right.
Yeah, so, you know, we drive, you had that S10,
yeah.
Right? We drive this S10 across country with her, you know, small amount of stuff in it and get to LA and load up. And, you know, we both kind of had to be at work the next day and here we are. And she's calling me saying, I'm on this street corner and nobody around me is speaking English and I'm not sure what to do. And I'm like, what are they speaking? And she's like, well, I think they're speaking German and that sounds like Spanish. And I don't know what those guys are speaking, but they're all different languages and everything. And I'm like, well, that's Southern California. It's, you know, it's what you get.
Welcome to the life.
I was so scared out there. The first year was the hardest because I missed home tremendously. I didn't go away to college. I lived with my parents until the day I moved out to go live with Kevin in California. And
and boy, were they happy about that.
They were not happy about that. And so I was in culture shock. I didn't know. I was so naive. I had no idea so many things. But I was very fortunate. I worked at the law firm and I met some original California girls, you know, the Valley girl.
For sure.
And they thought I was just hysterical. Like they couldn't,
really?
They couldn't not talk to me because they just had no idea what was going to come out of my mouth. And, then they would teach me about California and I would teach them about the Midwest and all the farm things that we did. And, I owe them so much because they trained me and taught me so many things and helped me with all my questions, no matter how offensive they may have been or inappropriate, because I just didn't know. I was so ignorant.
Know.
I just didn't know. So I was very fortunate. I met some really great people. And Kevin continued to travel, and I stayed in California. And we had a roommate, Kyle, that is a college friend of Kevin's. And so Kyle then took me under his wing as well and taught me, you know, other things about living with other people and
sushi.
Other things. No, I never have eaten sushi.
You haven't?
No.
As much as she fishes, you'd think there'd be sushi.
No. But yeah, I had some really good support people out there with us. You know, that Kevin introduced me to some amazing friends and things that helped me adjust to California. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No, that makes all the difference.
It did.
People who support you in somewhere that you're not used to or you don't understand. I mean, you could easily just auger in without having any kind of support system out there. So that's great.
Yeah.
I mean, that's fantastic.
It was a big deal. And especially my buddy Kyle was also from... the area near where Kelly grew up, just up the road. And I had known him all through college. So her and him had a connection from going to the same places, you know, back home, which was nice because they're both small town, you know, Midwest farm people. Right. So then when I would leave, I mean, as we tell the story, I think about how many different things that could have gone wrong. Because right. if I was leaving every weekend, which I was every third weekend going to Florida or going to wherever shooting races, if I left you there by yourself completely, that wouldn't have gone well.
No.
So luckily Kyle was there and you did meet people at the law firm and you got comfortable and started settling in a little bit. And then we both kind of decided that we wanted to make a go at starting a business, right? So I was producing Hot Rod TV and that was going, you know, pretty well from a production standpoint. I was an employee producer, so I worked for the publishing company that published Hot Rod Magazine and just did the TV show.
But, and I was doing a bakery at home, remember?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, you were entrepreneurial and and killing it with the bakery. My gosh. Mm-hmm. Her bakery basically financed our move back to the Midwest.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, the lawyers out there, you know, they got expensive taste.
Yep.
So yeah, true.
One of my deals was I knew enough or thought I knew enough anyway that I could produce a show. I just needed a few resources, you know, mainly money. But I knew enough people in the industry to where if I wanted to do an automotive show, I could probably get some commercial sponsors, and I had sources of content that I could go shoot at, and I knew enough production people and, you know, gear and all that stuff and how to edit and shoot and all that. So I said, do you want to try this? And it was right after the SEMA show in 2003 in November. And that was a hot situation because, you know, our buddy Doug Evans, who was my big boss at the time.
Right.
And I had prepared a sales video for him for the SEMA show. He was going to do this big presentation, and the video player failed and it didn't go well. And I thought, I'm done. It's
That's
over.
That's it. You know?
That was the kick in the ass to, you know, to do something here because it wasn't going to be pretty. So we decided to leave, and I want, you know, to do this production business. California was where a lot of the resources were, but it's very expensive. And the type of program that I wanted to do involved working on cars, which meant, you know, maybe a shop and space. And it was just, you know, piling up how much this thing was going to cost. And I had a connection with a network. It was called, at the time, it was called the Men's Channel. It was owned by a company called the Turner Networks Group, and the executive... a programming executive over there was a friend of mine, and he said, look, if you produce a show, we'll air it, you know, you're golden there. Except they were a new channel, so they weren't paying for content at that time. They were doing like either trade outs where they would own the show, or if I wanted to retain their rights, I would buy the time on the channel, and then I got to use my footage wherever I wanted forever because I owned it. So I knew I wanted to retain ownership, which meant now, in addition to the production costs, I'm buying TV time.
Which is not cheap, if anybody's asking.
Yeah. Right. Well, it was a different world back then, too. I mean, you didn't have YouTube, and streaming video was really the size of a postage stamp on your screen. It was totally in its infancy. And, you know, DirecTV and Dish Network were huge at the time. Mm. And today, I don't even know if either one of those are still in business. You know, it's all streaming. So we had the idea to go back to the Midwest to start this production business. And I grew up in the Chicago area in Park Ridge, Illinois. And I said, yeah, well, let's go back there because I know people and I got some family there and it's a lot cheaper than LA. So that's what we ended up doing. And the show, I there's a whole, can I, should I tell the story about how we financed the show?
Well, have the statute.
I mean, it's 20 years later. Yes, I think it's fine.
All right, here it comes. Okay, so we rented this house in Franklin Park, Illinois, which is right near O'Hare, and also right next to a train track. You know, commuter and freight. So, what I didn't account for is how loud it was going to be in that area.
And great for shooting video.
Exactly, and television has standards that are very different from the internet. You know, you can shoot whatever you want and stream it, but if it's television, you send a show to a channel, and if there's a train in the background or an airplane, they're going to kick it back. You know, it's quality control. You can't have that. So I was kind of battling that, but Kelly again got a nice job at a law firm downtown in Chicago. So she was commuting from our Franklin Park house, and I had set up a little office in the basement and was trying to get the show off the ground, right? So what does that mean? That means calling everybody I knew and trying to pitch them on being a commercial sponsor on this show that didn't exist yet. And It was a total relationship-based thing because I didn't even have any of the gear to produce the show at this point. I mean, really just had an idea. And the idea was, at the time, reality TV shows were really starting to come on. And people were starting to get sick of them, especially in the automotive side already, because it was this drama and whatnot. So our tagline was real, not reality. That was the whole point. And we were either going to show you that you could do this at home or you had to hire somebody to do it for you, but we weren't going to sugarcoat it and make a big dramatic presentation.
Right.
So the plan was to go to different shops and shoot the builds of cars. And we weren't far from Rad Rides by Troy and Schwartz Performance and... you know, the Roadster Shop guys were getting going over there, and you know, there were some decent shops in the Midwest that had content. There was a great restoration shop, Custom Cars Unlimited. So the backside of that was that, unfortunately, these people didn't understand, you know, in Southern California, if you say, hey, I'm going to bring your TV crew in and we're going to shoot here for a day, they're fine shutting everything down. You know, they understand that TV exposure is a good thing. So they'll, you know, whatever you need, shut down the whole shop and we'll shoot. Well, in Chicago, they didn't understand that. So we're trying to work around everybody else. And so those challenges presented themselves. But in order to get this thing off the ground, I needed to buy the airtime. And then I needed to physically produce some episodes to get them on the air. And I didn't have the money to do any of that. And I had to sell commercial time to finance this whole thing. So I had a contract on my desk from the channel that is, you know, as soon as I signed this thing, I'm on the hook for, at the time it was 5 years of delivering a new show every 2 weeks, half hour show. Mm-hmm. And to the tune of like, I don't know, 30 grand a month.
It was $20,000 a month that we had to go.
Yeah, cats.
It was easily that. So I'm looking at this contract and I'm like, So I'm talking to potential advertisers and they're like, so is it on the air? Can we watch this? You know, we'll watch a few episodes and see if we want to sponsor this thing or not. Well, we're not on the air yet. Well, when are you going to be on the air? Well, when are you going to sign a deal?
As soon as you cut that check.
Right. And so Kelly's working. I'm, you know, at home trying to get this done. And again, I don't even have the equipment to produce a show if everybody said go. So I really had to make something happen. And I ended up talking with our friends.
You got a signed contract.
Well, right? I talked to Royal Purple, and they, right. Our friend Mark McFan over there, said he'll back us because we had done good things for him in the past with Hot Rod TV and at events. So he was our first commercial sponsor, and he signed an advertising deal.
So we knew that there was a check in the mail, but we didn't know exact date or time.
Well, he had, you know, net 30. Here you go.
Right.
So that check's in the mail. So then I turn around and sign the commercial or sign the television contract. Okay. So now I'm on the hook, right? But I'm thinking the first payment will come in from Royal Purple and it'll all be good to go. I still don't have a show. And I still don't have a way to make a show.
Oof.
So I'm thinking, okay, what am I going to do here? And I called a friend in California and I said, can I borrow a camera or buy it, but pay you later? And he sent me a camera, but I still need an edit machine. I need, at the time the show was delivered on Beta SP commercial tape, which you got to rent a deck. A deck was 10 grand, you know, for this tape. I didn't have 10 grand for a deck. So I found a place that I could rent one, and it was like, you know, $150 a day to rent this deck. And I'm like, where am I going to get all this, right? Well.
Well, kids.
I had.
Here's where the story gets good.
I had in my possession an Amex card, and I got to do something. So I took the leap, and Kelly and I went out and bought a full Apple editing system on a laptop, Final Cut Pro version three or four back then. Bought some lights, got a tripod, got some wireless microphones, you know, everything I needed, bare bones to shoot this show, put it all on that card. You know, we racked up, I don't know, 20 grand or something on this credit
wow.
card. And I have 29 days and counting to pay that off in full.
Ooh.
So I'm still pounding the pavement and I'm starting to shoot some stuff. And Royal Purple, God bless them, they were the first ones to sign up. Holly was, I think, the second. MSD, I think, was the third. Cop Cams bought in. Jet Performance, Bear Breaks. Those were the team of companies that backed us. And their checks came dripping in one at a time.
Drip by drip.
And sure enough, I got the first episode done, got it sent out. It aired. The Amex bill showed up, money came in, I paid that, and we were off to the races. So it was all about taking this giant risk and letting it all hang out, you know, and it's sometimes what's necessary, and it was definitely a motivator. I mean, I don't think I slept that first couple of months to try and get this off the ground. So then we're shooting stuff, and that's when I'm starting to realize that this location really isn't the best place to do this because it's loud, and we get to somebody's shop, and they're like, oh, yeah, parts aren't here yet. You know, you got to go home and whatever. And I'm looking at the clock. I have 2 weeks to shoot a half-hour show myself, edit the whole thing myself, do all the voiceovers, all the writing, all the legal side of music and rights and clearances and all that nonsense, do all the graphics, and then convert it back to a beta SP tape and ship it off to the channel. So out of a 2 week cycle, you know, I got like 10 days worth of time to do this for 5 years, you know, every 10 days, you know, basically. So I'm thinking, you know, how are we going to get some sort of consistent content? You know, is there some way that we can just get a thing to shoot for a while? And the idea was, I was talking with our friends at Royal Purple, and I said, you know, they're like, how's the show going? And the commercials were airing, and they were getting response. Holly loved it. Holly used to call it, you know, the show was called VATV, you know, and but Holly called it the Holly Show because they were on it all the time, and it rang their phones, and they were very happy about it. But our friends at Royal Purple said, hey, you know what? We're thinking about building a car. Do you guys want to build it on your show? Do you want to build us a car? And I said, yes, that's exactly what I want to do.
Yes.
Because then I can control the content, and I'll have enough for the production side. And, you know, come on, building a, what are we talking about? Well, I don't know.
How 69 hard
Camaro.
Could it be?
Yeah. 69 Camaro, no problem, right? You build those in your
I don't have a shop or any tools or any crew. How hard could it be? I
mean, well, there's that. We'll
throw some wax on it and it'll be good to go, right?
Yeah. So Kelly comes home from work one day, and it was one of those, you know, 17 degree winter Chicago gray days, and the train station was 2 blocks from my house, but I would still pick her up in the car and bring her home because it was warm. And I said, hey, guess what? And at that point, okay, I'm doing all this at home, and she's the one that's got to get up and go to work, you know, go take the train and then walk and all this stuff.
Go through and the grinder.
Her vantage point is that I'm, you know, playing around in the basement doing nothing all day.
There was no supper on the table when I came home. Can you imagine,
How dare
Mike?
You, sir? How dare you, sir?
The dishes would still be in the sink. I was so mad.
So we come home one night, and I said, hey, I talked to friends at Royal Purple. It's some pretty cool news. And she's like, what's up? And I said, well, I think we're gonna build a 69 Camaro for the show. What?
We? What, you got a mouse in your pocket?
Exactly.
You speak French now? We? What?
It was one of the earlier insights that I've learned, and that is there are oftentimes things that I tell Kelly and she's like, I'm sorry, what did you say? It's just the opposite reaction occurs because she's looking at it from a different standpoint. So she's looking at it operationally, like she said, we don't even have a, you don't have a building, you don't have a car. We've got nothing to do this. And you just promised this for your little TV show project here.
For your little after-school special, Kevin.
Yeah. So as soon as that kind of set in, I'm like, yeah, okay, well, really, how are we going to do this? And Kelly's like, you know, if we moved back down to Southern Illinois where I'm from, we might be able to talk my dad into letting us use one of his farm buildings for your shop, you know, that you could build this car. And I was like, huh. And at this point, I had lived in the Chicago area. I lived in Los Angeles, you know, and now she wants to move back to this small rural town of less than 10,000 people. And I wasn't quite sure about that. But I thought, this is an opportunity, you know.
Yeah.
We kind of need to make this happen. So we loaded up the truck and moved to Waterloo.
Moved to Beverly.
Yeah, into this small little town. And I didn't know anybody outside of her and her family. And Kelly, it was at that point that, you know, her dad came through and helped us. He let us use the shop and helped us build the interior out and lights and insulation. And, you know, it was wonderful how much he helped and how generous he was to help that out. And after a couple of months of living in this small town, I started to really realize, I'm like, oh, my God, you left this to go to Los Angeles. Now I understand how crazy that must have been. Because I was having the opposite, you know, experience of big city to small town, right? So it took me a little while to really appreciate small town American life, which I love now. It's great. I wouldn't trade it for anything. And we ended up finding a car to build for Royal Purple. And we worked a deal with eBay Motors and where they were promoting our show. And the car, of course, was the Royal Sport Camaro, 1969 Camaro convertible. And it was the biggest pile that any television show ever tried to build.
Really?
It was a mess.
This thing was
rusted all the way through. And so the ace in the hole was Kelly's brother, John. And he's a master auto body, you know, hard hit crash technician with decades of experience. And I was talking to him about it, and he's like, well, you know, if you pay me, I can help you guys out after work. I'll do my day job at the body shop, and then I'll come out and you know, work on this Camaro. Wonderful. So here's the problem. The car was so rusty. We only ended up using the windshield frame on this Camaro, and rebodied the whole thing, okay?
Yeesh.
And, oh, by the way, we have a deadline because this is going to be a SEMA car.
Oh, man.
Yes. And it was then that our friends at Year One stepped up and helped us out with all the parts we needed, you know, at great deals for the promotion on the show and to help us get off the ground. And it was a mad dash of working all night. And it was Kelly and her brother and her dad and her mom and her niece and nephew on occasion and myself putting this car together. And I would be, you know, shooting the action at night when John was there doing stuff and then kind of working on things during the day. Kelly's mom was making us meals and her dad was helping out and offering up, you know, all the fasteners and tools.
Mm-hmm.
Our friends at HTP America got involved with welders and we're still using that same welder today that we used to glue that car together 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm. So what year is it and now? That
so now it's like
2005.
Yeah. So the inception of our business was in 2003. And then we were on the air in 2005 in April. Actually, on my birthday, April 8th of 2005 was when VATV first aired. And then by the end of that summer, by October, we were in the shop in the country building the Royal Sport Camaro. And well, with the idea to build the Royal Sport Camaro, we didn't get the car until like the following January. And then
we picked it up in the winter.
Yeah. And we had between it was a Chicago car, of course, you know, again, completely rusted out. We had to tear the whole thing down and rebuild it by SEMA, right?
For that year SEMA.
Yes.
Yeah.
We had
we
had like 8 months to do the whole thing. And starting from the bottom, So
yeah.
John's like, well, you know, the best way to do this is we're going to cut this thing apart into a million pieces, and then we're going to get all of the crash data on a 69 Camaro and build a jig. We're going to build a body jig and fixture the car to that, frame rails up, and just start sticking it together. So he tells Kelly, all right, I'll be at work tomorrow. You build this thing. Here's what you need to do. Look at this. Weld here and here and here, and you know, I'll help you out tomorrow. So Kelly built the jig, and you know, the two of us, you know, John checked all the measurements, and we set up a laser and all that stuff, and got it straight. But every single thing we had to do ourselves from scratch.
Of course.
And
with minimal tooling.
Right.
Mm. My goodness.
We had tools that could get it done, but it wasn't like...
Not like today.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
So we had a couple of toolboxes from SK Tools of good hand tools, and then we had those HTP welders. And Holly came through. At the time, they had just bought the NOS franchise. You know, they licensed that energy drink, so they were supplying us with that.
Nice.
Which is how we basically got through that year.
Yeah, and Fritz had 5-gallon buckets of bolts that I had sorted since I was three. Yeah. And nice. He had a pile of scrap metal out by the woods that we would go to frequently.
Because... The car wasn't a stock 69 Camaro convertible. It was the very first Schwartz performance chassis ever done.
No kidding.
Number one.
I'll be darned.
And Jeff was great to work with, except for the fact that he had never put one of these on a car. And we had basically an entirely new body that was all made from aftermarket parts. So those dots needed to be connected, and we had to physically fit the car to the chassis. And Jeff came down to the shop and took some measurements and notes and helped us and put revisions into his future chassis, you know, prototyping off that one. So that wasn't like, oh yeah, chassis here, it'll be rolling by 3 p.m. You know, it was a good amount of work. And at the same time, this is going to be a SEMA car. It's got to be nice, right?
Yeah.
So it had to be gapped. It had to have, you know, show car paint. It had to have fit and finish. So we were slamming on this thing. And it's funny to think back. So summertime 06, fall of 06 is when we were building this thing. And that's before YouTube kicked off. Like, YouTube was starting to happen right around that same time.
Right.
And I had a different deal with a web service provider that was doing our website. And they had video streaming capability. And I started shooting blogs back then. Nightly of the build of the Royal Sport Camaro. And you got to remember, this is a tape camera. So you'd shoot a half an hour of tape, and then it took a half an hour to transfer that into the computer. And then you had to edit it. It was all real time. You know, there was no file transfer. It was tape transfer. So we'd get home from the shop at three in the morning. And then I would edit, you know, for an hour and then go to bed and post this stuff. And I don't know if anybody ever saw these things. You know, it was just... just something that I thought was cool. So I'm doing the television show, which was different content, by the way, than the video blogs, because the video blogs weren't using all the lights and microphones, and the channel would have kicked them back. They weren't nice enough. So they had to be separate. So now I'm doing double duty there. Kelly is welding, grinding, block sanding, assembling, you know, this whole car. We started calling friends. We met friends. Nick Scavo came down and TIG welded the exhaust system up for us. Our buddy Brandon Ryan came down and wet sanded the car. Mike Cotton came down and helped out for a little bit. And again, like I said, Jeff Schwartz and some other local guys, Brett Evans and Trevor Knapp, a buddy of Kelly's, and some other local people. And we had kind of this all hands on deck thing. So I think we painted the car eight days before we went to SEMA? 8 or 9 days?
I think so. Yeah, I feel like it was in the 2-week window.
Oh, my word.
In a barn.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
We washed from the ceiling to the floor, the whole room, and we wet the rocks outside so that the dust would stay down in a shed with I'm going to call it an exhaust fan, but it wasn't really, you know... It was totally farm-built paint booth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I still, even though I've seen the building, I've been to the farm, and the first time you pointed out to me, Kevin, oh, yeah, this is where we shoot the show. I think I called you a damn liar because from what I saw on these videos that I used to watch and looking at this building, there's no way this is the same building. There's no way. The building you shoot in looks so much bigger than this little two-car looking, you know, garage.
Yeah. Well, and the shop was like 20 by 32, I think. So yeah. It wasn't very big. And the booth, in quotes, was next to it. And it was, you know, just big enough to put a car in. And, yeah. So your reaction was the very same as, like, people that would go to Graceland or go to South Fork because they watch Dallas on TV. And they're like, this looks like this giant mansion on TV. And I get here and it's like a two-bedroom house. Television, especially if you do it right, has a way of making things look larger than life. And you were watching us on television back then. And we were going out into 35 million households at the time, 40 million households, and pretty soon 50 million coming out of this little barn in the middle of nowhere with a bunch of people that are just doing it. You know, we weren't making any money at it. Every dollar we took in had to go somewhere else, you know, to pay bills and pay airtime and all the rest. And the car got painted on that frame jig, like I said, about eight or nine days before the show. And so at that point, we're like so focused on getting this thing done, we didn't realize we had no way to get it there.
Oh, jeez.
We didn't own a truck. We didn't have a trailer. I mean, we had nothing, right? So we start making phone calls, and Kelly's brother was gracious enough to loan us his diesel Ford pickup truck. And we called Scavo back, and he knew a guy that he raced with that had a box trailer that he loaned us. So we're running, you know, 20-hour days doing the SEMA thrash before that was even a term, and finally got this car. And the crapper of it was is it didn't run. It wasn't 100% finished. It was close. But we had so many commitments that we promised them this car was going to be there that we got it there. And we had kind of a fun little cheering section with our friends at lateralg.net and protouring.com because I was posting photos every night on those forums back when you did that.
Sure.
You know, and it was cool. It was and I still talk to a lot of those guys. They're still friends. And we find ourselves getting all packed up and ready to go. I don't even know if we had a hotel. Where did we even stay?
No, we didn't book anything. No.
Oh, my goodness.
And
we were like, if we stop, because we were in so much of a hurry to get there. No, if we stop, we'll just find something on the side of the road.
No, I'm talking about in Vegas. I don't think we had a place to stay. You know what? Royal Purple gave us a room.
Yes.
They took care of us because it was their show car. So they got us the room. And that was
that first year.
Because we were done. And we were so tired that we pull out of the farm with the car loaded up and it's all strapped down and detailed and covered and perfect looking. And, you know, Kelly's driving and I'm in the passenger seat. Okay, let's go. And I think we lasted about 40 minutes. And she's like, I'm asleep. We got to switch.
Oh, no.
So we pull over on the side of the road, switch. She jumps in the back of the pickup truck, goes to sleep. I drive. I'm only good for a half an hour. I pull over. Geez. I'm like, I'm smoked. So she wakes up. We switch again. We had to switch 50 times before we got there.
Yeah. Neither one of us could make it. Neither one of us could make it like 50. We couldn't even make it 100 miles without having to switch. We were so exhausted till day two and a half. Yeah. Day two and a half. We're like, okay, I think I can do a couple hundred miles. Go back to bed.
Holy and then I remember you driving that thing across Hoover Dam and through those tunnels.
I swear I scraped every wall.
So this is not our truck, not our trailer, not our car.
Gee whiz.
First time going with a SEMA vehicle. Yeah.
Oh,
and we
my
got
gosh.
There. I'm trying to think of what time we showed up. And it was like 11 o'clock at night, maybe?
Yeah.
On Sunday, I think.
Sunday night. All the cars were out front. All the barricades were up. And we just started moving stuff and driving through.
We literally just drove. We pushed cones out of the way, drove the trailer up to where the Royal Purple display was outside and start unloading this thing. And the security guards are like, hey, where's your credentials? I'm sorry, what? Yeah. Well, who are you? What are you doing here? You know, this is a thing. You can't just bring a car here. Oh, well, the car belongs to Royal Purple, you know? Yeah. Well, no. And then I was thinking of anything I could possibly say to help out, you know, help the cause. And it's like, well, Peter McGillivray is a friend of mine, and he was vice president of the show at that point. And they're like, yeah, whatever. So we just didn't stop pushing the car, and we just rolled it out and pushed it into position. And these guys are standing around, and we're like, okay, thanks. And we didn't even lock the trailer. We closed the door, latched the, you know, hung the lock on it, and just drove out and went to the hotel that Royal Purple got us. And there we were. We made it.
Oh, brother. You probably slept for 3 days.
No,
after
you had to go work SEMA because Kevin had all of his interviews and things to do for the TV show.
Exactly. And that was when we would shoot interviews all day, and then I would edit those every night, all night, and get those online before anybody else was doing that either. So we'd get to bed.
And that meant that Kelly was the camera operator.
Mm. Yeah. I'm on camera, she's shooting, and then we go back and I'd edit, and then we'd post these things and get to bed by 4 a.m. and wake up and do it again for the whole week.
Oh, Lord. Did Royal Purple take possession of the car then?
No. You
didn't have to bring it
back.
We
brought it back, and we finished it and then delivered it.
Yeah, so we brought it back to the
SEMA
shop.
So it was SEMA finished for the SEMA show, but then got finished afterwards.
Yeah, that's when we put our test smiles on it and stuff like that.
Gotcha. I don't even want to call it SEMA finished because there wasn't really people bringing not running cars to SEMA at that point. I mean, Trepanier did with the Blowfish land speed car and Bear Steel. You know, that kind of thing would happen. But nobody, and I'm not saying it's a good thing, but nobody was bringing, you know, half-finished cars to the show. And ours was way more than half-finished. I mean, it was a couple of weeks of electrical work and some fuel lines, and it was ready to go. We just ran out of time. And I wasn't really proud of the fact that it didn't run. I just wanted to make sure that we told all these companies that it was going to be there, and it was there.
Right.
And we brought it home and did all the finish work on it and drove it and got it tuned and all that jazz. And we took it to the Year One Experience in Braselton, Georgia, and then we handed the keys over to Royal Purple at that event, and they took it from there.
Okay.
Yeah, and we finished shooting our television episodes on the completion of the car, and, you know, the whole SEMA story was part of the TV episodes and the whole thing, right? So we get home, and it's like, okay, we built this car, we shot these episodes, you know, now what?
Uh-huh.
And people were watching the show, and they were coming to our website, and they're saying, hey, I saw you build that Camaro. I want you to build one for me. I want a car.
Nice.
Okay.
Well, okay.
Right, and I'm looking
part of
like
the plan, but all right.
Well, my problem was the plan lasted, you know, 15 minutes into the future. That's really all I predicted. I needed something to do like right now to be able to satisfy commitments, to generate some income. This just had to happen now,
sure.
And I knew that we wanted to do things to a high level of quality and everything. These weren't TV cars; these are real cars that were done very, very well. And people saw that it came across. So my buddy Pete called and he hired us to build the Reloaded Camaro, which was another SEMA car. I think the first 9 cars we did were all SEMA cars.
Wow.
All complete custom builds, you know, top to bottom with a very skeleton crew, a handful of a couple of people. And, so we would do one. And as we're building that one, somebody calls and says, well, hey, I want one. And then somebody else, well, hey, I want one. So now all of a sudden we got 3 cars and 3.5 cars, and we still didn't have any extra space. And it was just Kelly and I and her brother, and, you know, we'd hire a hired hand here and there, and her dad and her mom.
Yeah.
And her mom and dad are like, this ain't cool.
What do you mean? They loved it. They absolutely loved it.
They loved it, except for the fact that we didn't know what the boundaries were at that point. So we would hire people that would come to Kelly's dad's private property. We didn't have a storefront. We didn't have a phone book. You know, we were just this private little thing that existed to generate television content. And we'd hire people to come out there and work. And then, you know, because your family is who they are, they'd invite them in for dinner. So we're all sitting around the dinner table, and there's 10 of us, you know, with your family and your brother's family and you and I and a couple people, you know, there's 10 people sitting around the table, and your mom's feeding everybody. And your dad's like, No, we're not doing this. And to give you a little idea of what was going on, the farm building didn't have running water, and it didn't have a bathroom. I mean, we had a porta potty outside, and we had a tank full of water with a spigot on it, you know, all winter long.
We washed our hands in,
right. We washed our hands in that and then used the porta potty. We started from nothing, man. And eventually, we got to the point where we're like, okay, we got to start looking for a bigger place, because we had car parts stashed all over the farm, and we had, you know, a couple of more people coming, and then all of a sudden we'd have customers come in, you know, and we didn't really even call them customers yet. That really wasn't the thing yet. It was just people that we were building cars for, you know?
Right.
And we were at the farm for almost 10 years, right, Kevin? We were at the farm for almost 10 years.
Wow.
Well, we moved out in 13.
So we got there in 2005, and we moved out in 13.
So we were there for 8 years, and we've only been in our shop for 10 now.
So no running water, no bathroom, minimal tooling, minimal space, very minimal internet, minimal sleep.
Chickens and goats and ducks.
Chickens, goats, my family feeding us, incredible nights, weekends, tons. Minimal income for 8 years.
Yeah. Just doing everything we could
to
make this thing fly.
Amazing, beautiful SEMA cars.
And the customers, a couple of them were local. Everybody else was far away. It was still people we'd never met, even to this day. Mm-hmm. And I remember when we started to build the Loose Change Camaro, it was a big car, you know, and a lot of fabrication and a lot of trick stuff. And Lou, the owner, would come out to the shop, and it's a three quarter mile long rock road to get into the shop. And do you remember what we used to do? We used to trailer his car to the end of the road to go drive it, to test drive it, and then trailer.
So we didn't get rocks
the road.
In the tires.
Yeah, so we didn't get it dusty or dirty or rocks or chipped. You know, all the stuff that we had to do just to try and keep that up, and eventually, the shop that we're in today opened up. It became available, and we weren't looking. We needed a place. You know, we're in the town of Redbud, Illinois now, which is it's turned out to be a fantastic place to have a business. The people are wonderful. There's just enough resources there to where we can do our stuff. But this building opened up, and I do you remember the first time we went and looked at it? We're both like, "There's no way. We can't do this. This place is not, this ain't going to work."
Right. We actually went and looked at the building that my office is in. And the guy that was selling it, he said, "Well, I don't know if I'm going to sell it to you or I'm going to sell it to the other guy, because he wants to have a collision shop. But if he starts his collision shop over here, then he's going to move out of the other one and you guys can move in there." So we went and looked at one building, but we actually moved into a different one first.
Yeah.
And we started the very back room we borrowed from the collision shop, and that's where we did our body work, but we still did everything else at the farm. So we were split about 10 miles apart. Yeah.
Yeah.
We kept everything at the farm for about a year or two.
Yeah. Yeah, easily.
Yeah.
And the paint booth wasn't even a paint booth. It was a room with fans. So not like the old farm room with fans, bigger than that, but a room with fans.
And
the collision shop was
very
using
tricky.
The collision shop's using it every day to fix bumpers and, you know, hail damage and crashes. And we're like, "Hey, we got this Camaro straightened out. We got to get some primer on this." And they'd be like, "Oh, sure. Well, you can come in this weekend, you know, and if we get our stuff done and out, you can use the paint booth." So all of a sudden, we had to do overnights over the weekends to try and get stuff primed and painted, because we didn't have a booth, right? And then we said, "I'll tell you what, let's rent a booth." I remember reading about this in Hot Rod Magazine, man. "Go to a local body shop and tell them you'll give them $50 and they'll let you use their booth," right? We find a gentleman with a body shop who's 50 miles away, who's like, "Well, you know, for..." At the time, I think he wanted $350 or something to use the booth, because it was a baking blow therm downdraft booth, and it took money to run the furnace, you know, to bake it. So we'd rent that from him, but it was the same story. "Yeah, you got to bring all your materials, You can't use any of my stuff because my stuff is my stuff. And then you got to do it overnight. So Kelly and I and her brother would pack gallons and gallons and gallons of color, clear, reducer, brush cleaner, activator, hardener, everything, you know, tape, mask paper, tack cloths, the spray guns, everything we could possibly think of to paint a car into the trailer with the car, truck at 50 miles, unload it all, and paint the thing overnight to be able to use the booth. So the Rowdy Firebird was done there, the 69 Bird, as was the SS 496 Chevelle. In the rented booth, you know.
In the rented booth.
So, room by room, we were able to get into the building that we're in today. As the other business started to move out, and then slowly we kind of took that over. But at that point is when YouTube and social media started, and digital media, and coupled with the television show. And next thing you know, we got a couple of cars waiting to come in. And then we got five cars waiting to come in. And then we got 10 cars waiting to come in. And we got six people on staff. And then we have eight people on staff. And it kept growing just to satisfy the need and the demand. And it's tricky because, you know, we always want to maintain that quality standard of doing things that are top notch. But as you grow, you know, that not every customer is at that level. You know, some people just want their carburetor tuned, and it's like, well, we can't deny those guys because they're part of the scene, and it's a valid, you know, thing. So our customers that we build cars from, they watch our stuff on YouTube and then contact us. And even that has been a little bit of a shift because, you know, interestingly, a guy calls us up and says, hey, can you do this, you know, C3 Corvette with an LS3 and a 6-speed and some suspension? And we go, sure, it'd be a great project. And we build this Corvette for him, put it on video, put it on YouTube, and it also aired on the television show. And I'll throw a number at you today. Last month, for example, the term C3 LS swap was searched 1.6 million times on YouTube.
Whoa.
Last month, okay? There's 24,000 videos that cover that topic. We are number one, number three, and number four.
Nice.
Yeah. So you look at that as, that's a marketing home run, right?
The problem is... C3 hell, baby.
Right. Everybody with a C3 contacts us, which is cool, but it's not the same because we were used to building different cars every time, and now it's... You know, we got to keep the lights on and keep everybody moving. And we've got this pattern of some of these cars. We make them all different, you know, and they change and whatnot. And some people want an engine, some people want paint, you know, and all that stuff. But in order for us, you know, using YouTube as a way to share our work, we have to show that, which means we've got to build it. So when we look at what's in the shop and, you know, like right now we're doing that 57 Ford Ranch Wagon with the John Kazi Stroker camera motor in it.
Good grief.
A lot of custom work, a lot of fab work, a lot of really cool stuff, Roadster Shop chassis and down the line. So we're shooting a big video series on that one. And when that airs, is it going to be the eight guys in the world that want a ranch wagon? You know, to all reach out to us? Or is it going to be people that go, oh, you guys built a badass custom car.
Yeah.
I have an idea for a custom car that I want you to build.
Right.
But the most important thing about all this has been the ability to work with a crew that you know, kind of understands what we're trying to do and brings it every day. And brings talents that Kelly and I never even dreamed of. You know, when we were building these cars in the farm shop, her brother was obviously the most talented guy around in our little world. But now with metal workers and our interior shop and our paint and body team and our technicians that know far more than we did, you know, that to me, that's the neat part of where the growth is. Because now I walk through the shop and I'm like, wow, damn, that's pretty cool. How do you do that?
Right. Well, I say that every time I go down there and see all the stuff in that shop. It just blows my mind every time.
Yeah, it's really something. And of course, Kelly has been the one behind a lot of the growth, recognizing that there's people knocking at the door that want services, and we should accommodate them. So mm-hmm. we went from the one building we were renting to the one next door to that, to the little house next door to become the interior shop, to the building across the street, which is now where we store parts and warehouse. And there's a lot of fun things coming down the pike, yeah. right?
It's been fun. Now I'm just sitting here thinking, gosh, in only 10 years, we went from no running water to four buildings and 23 people on staff. It's like, what the heck happened?
That's crazy.
Well, it is crazy.
I remember coming down. I think the first time I ever came down to visit, you were having a sale. Your first open house, we met you at the first
swap meet open house sale that we had at the shop with the extra parts that we had already accumulated and had too much.
You had given me taking me on a little tour of the shop, mm-hmm. and this is where this is going to go, and over in this back room is where we're going to do the fabrication, and mm-hmm. I was like, this is great. You'll never need anything ever besides this building. It's going to be amazing.
yeah
but I was really blown away at how you're able to make all that work and get things running and just growing from that, and you know, from humble beginnings to where you are now. It's just nothing short of amazing.
Well, and the way Kevin tells the story, I mean, this is so much the abridged version, but you know, from the farm where we had, you know, there was a cat on my bench where I refurbished the parts, and then I would leave my chair, or my chair would physically be touching the jig that the car would be bolted to, where then I would cut, weld, grind for 6 hours, and then I would, you know, look up a part of my laptop, or I'd refurbish mm-hmm. something, and then I'd go into the next room and my brother would spread the body filler and I would block sand it. And you know, the space that we worked in was so small, but I was on a 60-acre farm, you know, so I felt like I was in this big open space. And then I could literally, you know, my desk I had to clean off every day because I had all these metal shavings all over it. So when we moved down to Redbud, I put my desk in the mechanics room with the mechanics, you know, and again, we were still in this smaller space, and I could hear someone else weld, and I would holler, you know, turn up the wire speed or give it more heat, or because I was in the room. But of course, every time I'd get on the phone, the day with the hit an impact wrench, or I couldn't have a conversation to save my soul. And I always had to wear bib overalls because the heaters sucked. And I was by the front door, so there was always a breeze. And I remember at the farm, you know, layer upon layer of clothes because the heaters were terrible too. And
well, and you had animals in your overalls.
Yeah, I carry an animal around in my pocket or something, and dogs in the shop and all that stuff. And then ducks and chickens too.
Yeah, you know, so Kelly's there trying to make phone calls with grinders going off. But, you know, earlier at the farm, I'm outside trying to make an important phone call and a flock of chickens goes off all around me. And everyone's like, where are you, man? On a farm or something? No. I'm in my my New York office here. You know, this is we're a legit business, you know.
Right, man.
Yeah. For sure. And like we intentionally, I had to go to town every day to pick up our parts when we were on the farm, because my dad did not want all these strangers at the farm. So anytime a vehicle would pop over the hill at the farm, he'd be, shut the doors, and who's that? What are they doing here?
Oh,
and
no.
Oh, yeah.
So then we went to Redbud, and they, you know, we got parts delivered to the shop now, and
we had a bathroom.
It was still outside. It was like an old gas station bathroom.
Yeah,
you know?
That bathroom,
so if it snowed. Yeah, so if it snowed, the snow blew in and froze the toilet and cracked it, and oh goodness! But we had a water leak that we'd never had before. That was amazing.
Yeah, you know, and it's funny because like, so Trevor started working while we were still at the farm. So he made the transition. He remembers what it was like.
Yeah,
we have people today that you know, obviously don't understand that because they haven't been with us very long and don't know what that was all about. But the perspective, you know, not only did we move into this other shop, but Kelly systematically like revamped every aspect of the shop. So it was reconfiguring rooms, adding heat, adding lights, adding bathrooms,
insulation,
shelving, you know, tin on the walls, reconfiguring things, you know, and then the outside got completely remodeled and new offices got built finally for me and for the, you know, other people, the salespeople and the parts guy and Kelly finally got her own office when we acquired the body shop.
After 15 years.
Away from all the working.
Uh-huh. Yeah, right. And today there's, you know, it's funny. So her and I never signed up to be small business owners. That really wasn't what this was all about. Uh-huh. I always wanted to do, you know, television and radio and I always loved cars and loved to build cars and be around, you know, cool cars. And, you know, Kelly's deal was she worked in a law firm and got all kinds of professional experience, but it was good for her to be able to work close to home, close to the farm and the family. But her lineage, that's what they do in her family is build things and improve things.
Right.
And the people are always first, you know, the crew always comes first. So if somebody, you know, we need another welder, well, we're going to get another welder. You know, it's not like Kelly and I have a 60-foot boat in the back, you know, it's not like that at all. Every dollar goes back into this business and partially because we don't know any different, you know, we're not like, we didn't open up a manufacturing company with the intent of, hey, if we sell 5 million widgets, we'll make 38 cents on each one and we'll be able to retire. I mean, that's not what this was. This is purely about building cool cars and just kind of doing something that's different that we're passionate about. And I've mentioned Sarge before on our show. He's our warehouse manager and all around guy. And he and I were talking one day and he's like, so let me get this straight. When you were a kid, you wanted to build hot rods. Well, yeah. Didn't everybody, you know?
Right.
I said, so you ended up building a business and a shop so that you would have the opportunity to eventually someday build a car. He's like, you kind of did that backwards. Because I still haven't built a car.
For
you know. I mean, I have a couple, but it's...
Right.
But the other thing I think is important to point out is that if you're going to work in a place like this, you got to love it. This is not the place you go to work 9 to 5, cash your check, and go home.
Right. I
mean, you have to care about everything that you're doing so that you're giving it all the quality that it deserves. And you're giving the customer the experience that they deserve because this is their passion too. We're not making plastic cups or something that nobody cares about. Kelly and I did some time to make this happen. And the time we did was all those late nights and all of that attention to detail and all those high-end cars and going to all those events. Not really knowing what the payoff might ever be. It really wasn't about that. It was about being able to do it, you know?
Yeah. So just digging in and just duking it out and moving forward. I mean, there's a certain romance in that, in starting out the way you guys did and just never quitting and never saying no and just moving forward and seizing those opportunities when they come your way, like with the Royal Sport Camaro. And then finding this building in Redbud to move into and be able to grow your business the way you have and all the late nights that you've put in. It's really, really amazing. And you got to look at each other once in a while and just say, holy cow, look at what we did. Look at what's happened.
We've said, holy cow, look at what the hell happened. but, you know, you're right. And it's funny because we're not the kind of people that do that very often. We don't step off and go, hey, look at how great this is, because we're very involved in it. And there's always something to work on and something to improve or some, you know, dare I say, some fire to put out or, you know. Mm-hmm. And what they don't tell you is you get it from all angles. You got customer relations and you get finding customers and, you know, making the shop busy from that standpoint. Then you've got at the team, and everybody's got their own concerns and their own life situation and their own, you know, their own lives. And then you've got the government, and you got to deal with taxes and regulations and laws. And then you've got insurance, and you've got all these things that they didn't tell you, you know, you had to pay for.
We just wanted to build cars. We didn't know we had to do all that other stuff.
Right.
This is bullcrap, man.
Exactly. And I walk a fine line here because I don't want to come across like we're a bunch of idiots that are just throwing darts against the wall, because I don't think that's true. We wouldn't still be here if that was true.
I think it was systematic growth. I think I look back over the 20 years, and every year we were in business, we grew in some capacity. And recently I've had conversations with employees or other people about what's the next growth steps. And some people will think, wow, you know, you're growing so fast. And I'm like, no, I've been growing for 20 years, and this is really a thought out process.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a method to the madness to a degree. Even though we might not fully understand it, we kind of know the direction we want to go in. And that's very simple. It's, you know, the mission statement to connect people with the best times of their lives through things with wheels, but also to make sure that our team is taken care of, that we're putting out a high quality car, some fun trivia. We've never had to lay anybody off because there wasn't enough work. Everybody always gets paid, you know, these are core to who we are. We want to make sure that, you know, that's the important stuff. Mm-hmm. And I can't help but think that, you know, Kelly had a little chuckle of revenge when she said, hey, you know what? The building next door is becoming available, and I think we're going to buy it. And I'm like, what? And I think that was payback for, hey, well, let's build a 69 Camaro. It'll be easy.
Oh, she played a long game, baby.
Well, I, you know, I can be pretty conservative a lot of times.
The saying of all you got to do is.
Well, thanks. You know, that has come back to get me more than once.
Okay. And my brother said it ain't no hill to a climber.
Yeah, that was his famous words as we're building this Camaro. And it's like, picture this, Mr. Cue Ball. Yeah. It's the end of July, and we have a Camaro that's supposed to be at the SEMA show at the end of October. And it is nothing but frame rails on a jig at this point, at the end of July, in a box full of parts. And I look at her brother and I'm like, dude, we got a problem. We got to get this thing done. Oh, it ain't no hill to a climber. Oh, okay.
Do I look like I'm wearing climbing boots, pal?
Yeah, who are you, UConn Cornelius over there? So I get. we get the car done and finished, and it does what it's supposed to do at SEMA. We come home, and I tell John, you know, I said, man, looking back, it was kind of dicey there for a while. You know, when I'm looking at this pile of parts, we only got a couple of months, and you say it's no hill to a climber, and he goes, I said that. and you didn't hit me? I'm like, oh, man, really? He's like, I wouldn't have believed that if I said that. I don't know what the hell that was all about.
I said that?
Yeah, I know, right?
Yeah.
But I think at the end of the day, we're just super fortunate that, you know, the time investment has worked, that we still have a strong personal relationship, having been what we've been through. And that, you know, as you pointed out before, our first date was working together, and that's what we know. So that's kind of what makes it all work. And somewhere we continue to get fuel for this fire. You know, every once in a while, Kelly or I will wake up and go, you know what? I quit today. I'm done. I just can't do this. But then like 2 hours later, we're in the office.
Yeah.
You know, here's a great example. Last week I said, you know what? I think I'm going to take Thursday off. And Lisa, my assistant's like, that's a great idea. It's around the holidays. You should take Thursday off. What are you going to do? I don't know.
I'm thinking in my head.
Well, I'm thinking in my head, you know, I'll just work from home. I'll edit video or something from home, because remember, my job is fun for me. I like doing what I do. So what else am I going to do? I'm going to do this. And then when Thursday rolled around, I was in the office anyway, you know, and I'm not complaining about it, But it's just, I think when you look at a lot of small businesses in this country or anywhere in the world, that's what it takes. It takes people that would be doing this anyway and just want to make it succeed. And then that level of responsibility increases with each person you add to the team because they have families to feed and they've got their stuff. So you can't get off the gas at all. You got to keep it going and continuously find ways to make it better for everyone so that everything just keeps getting better.
Amen and hallelujah.
Hallelujah to that. So that answers that question. How did you guys get started? To all those who asked that one, I hope you don't regret asking it. Very fortunate.
It's a great very story. Cool story with a lot of amazing opportunities and people involved along the way, and major challenges that we somehow adapted and overcame and continue to do. And just the teamwork is the best part about it, that Kevin and I can work together. I mean, you got to think, we wake up in the morning, we eat breakfast together, we ride to work together, we work together in the same company, different departments, sometimes different buildings. We eat lunch together, we ride home together, we sit on the couch or at the dinner table together talking about everything we just did at work together, and go home and do it the next day, every day for 23 years.
Well, it's kind of funny because, you know, I travel a lot the past few years in the summertime doing other events, and she's actually like, "You're going to be gone again?" You know, and I'm like, "You're not done with me yet?" You know, we see each other all the time. And not that I don't want to see her. I wish she would come with me on this stuff. But you'd think that it'd be like, good, get out of here.
Knucklehead, get the hell out of here.
I'm done with you.
Teamwork makes the dream work. That's all I'm saying.
That's true. Right. That's true. I mean, Jenny and I, my wife Jenny and I, we don't work together. Obviously, you know, she goes to her job. I go to mine. But when we do come together on home projects, and we actually work really, really well together. We built our deck, and she was just as involved with everything as I was. And I took a week off of work, and I framed everything out. And she was, you know, she was there every step of the way with me. And she has great ideas. And every once in a while, I'll have a mediocre idea that gets implemented, but it's nice that we communicate effectively and we're able to come, you know, have a common goal and achieve that goal together. And I really, really, I'm really fortunate for that. So I'm really glad you guys have that too.
We both come home and it's like, oh, damn. And we don't have to say anything because we just went through it, you know.
Right. Together. You're in the trenches together for sure.
Yeah. So that makes, you know, it's an interesting perspective that not everybody gets. So we are very fortunate.
Right on. Right on.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know what also is very fortunate is everybody listening who are waiting for the answers to our riveting trivia questions. And I will just say thank you to everybody who hung on this whole thing because it was a long show, but we left a lot out.
A lot out.
Stay tuned for part two.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, so Kelly, you went first.
Yeah.
What was your question?
My question was, who invented a honing machine? Yes.
So Cue Ball said who?
I said Jebediah Hone in 1875.
Right.
Kevin said Horst Hearn.
Yes.
In 1766.
Yes. One of us is right?
So which one of us was right?
Neither one of you.
No.
Obviously.
Really?
But the answer really surprised me. It's Leonardo da Vinci in the 1500s developed a tool for machining tubes, wooden tubes at the time, that used a combination of rotation and stroking with an abrasive grit.
What?
Wow, that was the reason to listen to this show, right there.
Yes.
Leonardo da Vinci. Yeah.
Best Holy question mackerel. Ever asked on this show.
Thank God there was a payoff. That was good.
No doubt. No doubt.
Yeah. That's great.
And then in 1928, Joe Sonnen created the, obviously, the Sonnen Company, and he created the honing machine. But Leonardo da Vinci back in the 1500s. Isn't that amazing?
Wow.
Mm-hmm. That is amazing.
You know, I was like, gosh, Leonardo da Vinci came in a time where he came from nothing. Like, he had no tooling. He started out. He created beautiful things. So that's how I tied it together with us.
Mm. Nice.
Fantastic. All right, moving on. I asked y'all what were the factory production big block Chevy displacements that that were offered over the years. And
yeah,
Kelly
said, there's a couple of sleepers in there.
Yeah, Kelly said 454, 496, 396, 409, and 427. Kevin said 348, 396, 402, 427, 454, 502, and the goofy one.
Right.
Those were all displacements, big block displacements, but not all of them. The correct answer is 348, 366 cubic inch.
There it is.
396. That's the goofy one I think you're thinking of.
Yep. Yeah, I never heard of a 366. Okay. Yeah.
Truck motor.
396, 402, 409, 427, 454, and 496, which, Kevin, you said it was the 8.1 liter, but that was actually the 496, not the 502.
So Kelly did get that one right.
Kelly did get that one right, absolutely. I mean, everyone had fairly correct answers, but just not a complete correct answer.
Okay.
So half credit for both of you.
You notice when we work together, we got them all.
Ooh, nice.
Tears.
Mm. Oh, my gosh.
I just got chills.
You might want to see your doctor.
Yeah.
Okay. My question to y'alls was, what is the largest crankshaft in the world?
It's a huge one, isn't it?
Well, Kelly said it's 2,000 pounds and 20 feet long.
Yeah.
And Mr. Q said it's on a cruise ship and it's 10 tons with a 5-foot stroke. I mean, these are some big cranks.
Yeah.
You guys are talking about here. But not big enough.
Ooh.
The weight of the largest crankshaft is 300 tons.
What?
Oh, I'm telling you.
And what?
The stroke is 8.2 feet.
Holy
The bore is 38 inches, and it is a two-stroke turbocharged, low-speed diesel 14-cylinder engine.
Oh, my God.
And it's made by the Wartsilia company in Sweden.
Germany. Oh, Sweden. Okay.
Yeah.
What is it in?
Something big.
Something big.
Large container ships.
Oh. Okay.
Oh, Finland. Made in Finland.
Wow.
Yeah, it's 13.5 meters high and 26.59 meters long. Multiply that by 3 for feet, so like 77 feet long.
Oh, my gosh.
That's a big crank. What if you could shoehorn that into a 69 Camaro?
See what I'm saying?
Yeah.
We could do it.
Wow.
We got guys. We could do it.
You got talent. You got the talented crew.
For sure.
That's it.
We do.
Well, this was fun. Again, I know this is a long one. I appreciate everybody for hanging in, but we felt it was time to share that one. And Kelly, thanks for joining us. I know you're very busy.
Thanks for having me on. It was fun to recap about 20-something years ago and bring back all the memories.
That was cool. Yeah, man.
Mm, for sure.
I can't believe you publicized the story on how you got started from
sure
a
did.
Financial point of view. Mm.
You got to be willing to take a risk. That's the deal. And we had a plan.
Absolutely right. You got to be willing to take a risk.
And if it didn't work, we'd have found another way, but it was an option.
But it did work.
It did work.
I'm just happy I don't have to do it again, but it did. it worked. You know, like what they said, nothing ventured, nothing gained. So,
right on.
Yeah.
All right. Well, this has been an extended version of the VA Radio Podcast. If you enjoyed this, believe it or not, we do have more stories, and you will find them in your inbox if you hit that magic subscribe button. It's right there on your screen. Just go ahead and hit it. All right, go ahead, hit it.
Boom.
There you go.
Click.
And for Kelly Ostie and Mr. Mike Cuball Clark, I'm Kevin Ostie, reminding you that sometimes you just got to get out there and do it.
Make it count.
Make it count.